Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 40 years ago this month, the young life of Martin Luther King was rushing toward its tragic, glorious, world-moving crescendo. He was 37. He had marched in Selma, lived to see a Southern American president say, "We shall overcome," and act to prove it, won a Nobel Prize, and been blackmailed toward suicide by the FBI. In 2 years and a few months, he would be dead. The last years were a trial of the soul for the man and his country. "I don't want to do this anymore," King once shouted to his aides. "I want to go back to my little church." But he didn't. Up next on Point, Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Taylor Branch on the last years of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Joining me now from Baltimore is Taylor Branch. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1989 for the first volume of his epic trilogy on MLK, Parting the Waters. Pillar of Fire came out in 1998. His new and final volume is At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965 to 68. Taylor Branch, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be here.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Taylor.
Hi, Jack.
Taylor Branch, that is such a passage. We've heard it before, but it never fails to move from Martin Luther King in Memphis that night before his assassination. Take us back. When he said, "I'm not worried about anything, I'm not fearing any man," that may have been true, but he had a lot to worry about that night. Pile it up for us.
Well, the speech is haunting. Of course, when you hear it, the first thing that strikes you, or at least strikes me after all these years studying it, is the timbre of his voice. It sounds like a wood stove, quite independently of the words almost. You hear despair struggling with hope and hope struggling to overcome despair, and that's what's so distinctive about Dr. King. He's not Pollyanna. He knows that he's running against a tide of hatred. Speaking about death was not new for him. He did it all of his career. He gave the Drum Major Instincts sermon just 4 or 5 weeks before, on February 4th, when he in essence preached his own funeral. That was new. That was constant because of so many threats. This is he had just hid in his hotel room for 2 days in Miami, one of the few times he altered his behavior, because the threats that he would be shot in the lobby of a hotel in Miami were so specific that the police got him to essentially change his schedule. So this was constant. What was new in this speech is the notion that the movement he was in at the time for the Poor People's Campaign had kind of lost momentum in history, and he was saying behind the scenes, "We may be leaving a testament here, a testament of hope for the future," and that he might not survive to see it triumph the way he had triumphed in Selma, because weariness and war had more or less eclipsed his mandate, and a lot of Americans had even kind of lost track of where Dr. King was then, so that they were shocked when they got the news of the assassination. I remember this myself. I was a senior in college. "Well, where's Dr. King been since his speech in Riverside?" So he was in the backwater, and that awareness is what you hear new in this speech.
You're looking at the last 3 years in this book, up through 65 and Selma, and then President Johnson, LBJ, saying on air before the nation, "We shall overcome," and pushing the voting rights movement and succeeding in getting it through. Dr. King had brought the nation along with him. How did he outrun or go beyond where the nation was ready to go in those last 3 years, perhaps even go beyond his inner circle?
Well, he certainly did. I mean, his inner circle didn't want to go to Selma in the first place. I mean, when he won the Nobel Prize at the end of 64, and the Civil Rights Act of 64 outlawed segregation and established equal job opportunity not only for blacks but for women, it set into motion an enormous wave of change that has taken generations to change America. And his staff wanted to dine out on that for generations and of chicken dinners, but he felt obliged to go right back to Selma. He said, "The Valley calls me," and He had two young staff members, Jim Bevel and Diane Nash, who had been nagging him ever since the Birmingham church bombing to try to win the right to vote for black people across the South. And he went to Selma. He said, "The Valley calls me." So this was the beginning of the real prophetic ministry of King, where he's not struggling with the issue of the Brown decision and segregation, but he's struggling with what he called a larger violence of spirit, or, to put it positively, the larger possibilities of equal souls and equal votes to set an example, even beyond segregation and race, against the violence of the spirit in war, poverty, and racism, which was the trio that he indicted in his Nobel Prize speech.
Those become so lofty, put some meat on the bones of those very high kind of philosophical markers that he was setting there. What was he hoping for? What was he preaching for the country at that point?
Well, he wanted, he felt that the country didn't see a lot of things that were obvious to him, which was that the heart of democracy is nonviolence. He had been in a nonviolent movement. They were almost quivering with its potential after Selma. Andy Young gave a speech in which he said, it's like we've discovered a nuclear weapon and we have to be careful here because nonviolence can change the world. Dr. King saw it at the heart of democracy, and he felt there was so much violence in the spirit, working against the spirit of democracy, both in racism and hatred and lynching, but also in the fact that the poor were invisible, and that we thought that the way to advance democracy was by, as he put it, killing young brown children in Vietnam. And he said, there's something wrong with a country when they will applaud you for being nonviolent in the face of hatred in the South and Klansmen and sheriffs, but will curse you and revile you when you don't want to practice nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children, and you think that that's the way to advance freedom. So he had a very, very broad agenda that wound up isolating him toward the end of his life.
The goals became very high. The pressure around the tension between despair and hope, almost unmanageable, even for Martin Luther King. You quote him at one moment saying, "I don't want to do this anymore. I want to go back to my little church." What brought him to that pass?
He was at one of many staff retreats in a ferocious debate over whether the movement should go north, but whether the movement should throw itself into a headlong campaign like Selma to end the Vietnam War, or should devote itself to trying to raise the visibility of poverty and raise hope to end poverty in America. And there was a ferocious debate, and a lot of people didn't want to do either one. A lot of people simply wanted to consolidate the gains in the South and stay a Southern civil rights movement. And he got battered by his own staff, and this was in the era of black power and riots, and a lot of people were saying nonviolence was eclipsed. And in the face of all of those pressures, there were a number of times when he said, you know, "I'd like to go back to my little church and not have to deal with all of this," because not only did he have death threats from people who hated him every day, but he was getting buffeted by his nominal allies, Roy Wilkins and the NAACP, and then buffeted by his own staff, which had different agendas inside the movement.
Jack Beatty, Taylor Branch takes us all back in this monumental trilogy, now with Canaan's Edge, to that time. What are you reminded of as he unearths for us again this history, this man, this amazing moment in American history?
Well, first of all, congratulations, Taylor. Herman Melville said it takes a mighty subject to pull a mighty book, and you have done it. King has. You've done a monument here, and a living one. So congratulations on that. Well, you know, in reading this, I'm just struck with this thought, that King is on his mountaintop, but you have to wonder, would he be up there in the iconosphere if he had lived? I mean, as Taylor said, he's talking more and more in these last years about the inseparable triplets, racial injustice, poverty, and war, and he's shifting from a consensus position on racial injustice, it's wrong, to much more problematic views on violence infecting, as he put it, U.S. foreign policy and the economic system. "I'm sad to say it," he said, "but we live in a nation that is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today." He's speaking of Vietnam, of course, but also of an enduring propensity. And he goes to Memphis, where he's killed, to take the side of striking workers paid so little that they routinely applied for food stamps, just like many Walmart employees today. And, you know, that's the other thing. The King years are the equality years for our economy, when real incomes were growing by 41%. Imagine his witness today when, you know, after equality.
Let's get some more of that voice of Martin Luther King in our ear. Here, April 4th, 1967, in the middle of the 3 years that Taylor Branch is looking at this time, 1 year before his assassination, Martin Luther King spoke out against the Vietnam War at Riverside Church in New York.
So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony. Watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village, but we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago. I cannot be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor.
Martin Luther King, April 4th, 1967, speaking out against the Vietnam War. Taylor Branch, I want to get to Jack Beatty's big point, but to set the stage for it, remind us how the war drove a wedge between Martin Luther King and President Lyndon Baines Johnson, who had supported him after Selma.
Well, that's what makes this, gives this an element of Greek or Shakespearean tragedy, because the cooperation between King and Johnson was much more intimate than I expected. Johnson was far more willing to risk his presidency, as he put it, not just for my lifetime, but for yours, to his young aides, by losing his southern base and working with King and changing the whole partisan structure of American politics. But the Vietnam War was going on at the same time. And to hear King Johnson struggle with that and agonize over it and essentially say, I think I'm going to lose. We don't have any business doing this, but I've got to do it anyway because they'll run me out of office as a coward. American people will forgive you for anything but running. And he was afraid to be nonviolent in Vietnam as the way of trying to promote democracy there. And his relationship with King evaporated almost overnight, although it's also shocking to hear, to me, to hear King say to his aides, you know, I have never called Johnson's name in criticizing the war. It's not just his war. It's our war as a country. We're all responsible for it. We can't blame it all on one poor Texas school teacher.
So here he was outrunning the president who he had been allied with. Did he feel, was he very conscious that he was outrunning American public opinion as well? Johnson said he couldn't, you can do anything but run. How did King look at that?
Well, King looked at it as something that he said he never looked at things according to how popular they were. It was always considered a miracle that the Civil Rights Bill passed. It took a dozen, you know, 10 years of struggle, and the Voting Rights Act the same. He felt he was compelled to say what he thought, and of course that's what gives it a tragedy, that Johnson took one path to the democracy by violence and King took the other. And, you know, in the end, Johnson lost his presidency on Sunday and King lost his life on Thursday of the same week in 1968. So both violence and nonviolence were kind of encased in the conflict over what the 60s meant.
You also take us deep into the kind of unspoken struggles of that time. Dr. King struggling with his own infidelities and the U.S. government manipulating those, trying to drive him, you write, towards suicide. Remind us of that dynamic.
Well, there were a lot of people within the government who had their own private agenda that were profoundly threatened by what Dr. King was saying. The government was largely segregated itself. There was not a single female FBI agent, for example, and we have to remind ourselves this was an era when white females weren't allowed to go to most private colleges in America either. So there was a lot of animus toward King for raising the specter of change that was going to be uncomfortable for the American government itself. And you had people in the government who had been there in power for a long time and saw surveillance against the civil rights movement as a way of preserving almost royal prerogatives that they had grown accustomed to. And, of course, we have echoes of those same issues today with the justifications for and the arguments over surveillance in the era of terrorism. So this is a pretty contemporary story, but it was driven to large extremes in the FBI era.
He was anguished himself over these marital infidelities. That's part of the tension here. But how did the FBI bring those to bear in such a way that he got the message that he should kill himself?
Well, they sent him a tape. That occurred right before he went to Selma. It's occurred right at the end of my last book, but it informed the beginning of this, that they had essentially sent him surveillance tapes based on breaking and entering, where FBI agents used wiretaps to know where he was going and then went to the hotels that he was going to be staying and broke into the rooms where he was going to be and planted microphones in the walls, and then they took some of these tapes and mailed them to his house and said, you know what you have to do. They were trying to get him not to accept the Nobel Peace Prize. And as all of this was illegal, of course, and disgraceful to have a government agency responsible for enforcing the laws trying to get somebody to commit suicide rather than accept the Nobel Peace Prize, of all things. But that was the measure of the passion in that era.
Was it explicit? You should commit suicide to save your legacy. If you do, we won't release these. If you don't, we will release these, and your legacy will be destroyed? Or did he have to simply intuit that from communication?
Somewhere in between. Look into your heart. You know what you have to do. You only have 37 days to comply. You are a fraud and a disgrace, and you can't hold yourself up as anything other, and you have proof here. So it was, and it was written in kind of a street language threat, but and accompanying these tapes. So it was clear, but not quite as explicit as you made it.
And Jack Beatty here, Dr. King, this just one of the many tensions that he's riding there between despair and hope. Lay some of those out for us.
Well, I mean, I'm struck, Taylor, with just his guilt about the material comforts of life. Coretta Scott King, his wife, is trying to buy a house for $10,000, and he's terribly uneasy about that. How can I do that and still maintain the authenticity of my voice of speaking for the poor and for those left by the side, and he's got the struggles within his own movement, the temptations of violence. At one point, you say that nonviolence isn't easy. You've got to accept punishment but suppress rage, and many of his followers couldn't do that, especially the younger ones who looked, to be more to speak more to the mood that was in fact burning many American cities. So I imagine he must have been thinking to himself, have I started something that's going to devour what I want, what I stand for?
Taylor Branch?
Well, I think that's right. Coretta herself said that Dr. King was a guilt-driven man all of his life. He was consumed by remorse that there was so much suffering in the world, that he was relatively privileged as a middle-class black person growing up even in the Depression, and that he retained that all of his life, not just about material wealth, but just about a comfortable life. And there is arguments in his sermons that he's almost doing penance by taking risks in public life to be a prophet out of his own sense that, as he said in his own sermons, I'm not a saint. I'm not as good as people think I am. But there are plenty of people in history, and he would call out the examples who have had flaws in their private life, but have left us a legacy of purity in doctrine. And he would cite, Luther and Saint Augustine and Paul Tillich and other people, some of whom were obsessed with sex, but also obsessed. It made them more obsessed with trying to achieve purity in their public mission. And so that is kind of the furnace that you see with King. And Jack's absolutely right. Nonviolence is hard. But what King saw is that it is a perfect incandescent example of the discipline of democracy, where our attachment to the vote that we take for granted is nothing more than the discipline not to settle political problems by violence among ourselves, and to have a faith in public trust that we can build a government of fellow citizens instead of monarchs and subjects, you know, royalty and serfs. And in that sense, I think that it's true that King was a modern American founder. He's doing just what Jefferson and Madison did in trying to create fellow citizens where there had been hierarchy and suffering. And that's what he meant by this, you know, the violence of racism, poverty, and war. They're, you know, to him, they were lingering evils from the heart of, monarchy and despotism of the spirit.
Fred is calling from Florence, South Carolina. Hi, Fred, you're on the air.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I just think you got a great show, number one. I listen to it every day.
Thank you very much. Glad to have
you. I think you have two great guests on. The author that wrote the last book here, I had the opportunity to read the last one he wrote, I think, 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certainly looking forward to reading this one. But I think he's so correct on his whole observation on where Dr. King was headed and what he thought. And I think when it came to the Vietnam War, I don't, and I'll agree with you on that, Dr. King, I've never heard all of the speeches and all of the news conferences I ever saw him in. I never heard him say an ill word toward our former president, Lyndon Baines Johnson.
An ill word toward LBJ. Never heard it?
I never heard him say an ill word toward LBJ. He talked about the wall, but he did not talk about LBJ wall.
Fred,
you know, he was talking about the America wall.
Yeah, Fred, we'll check that with the biographer here and see what he has to say. But what about Martin Luther King and how he's understood and remembered today? How do you see him?
Well, I see it as, number one, I think I Have a Dream speech is not the one that I really think made his legacy. I think it's one about I've been to the mountaintop. That was the most important speech, and I think he was talking about his death at that time. But I also think that Dr. King was unique and that he knew that, not like the NAACP and some of the moderate civil rights organization, that it was going to take direct action in order to change anything. And I think he proved that in Birmingham and in Selma, that, you know, that we couldn't sit back and expect the courts to do anything, because the courts at that time was dominated by ultra-conservative, racist federal judges in the South at that time.
And Fred, you're very well informed. Let me ask you one more thing. To Jack Beatty's point, if Martin Luther King had lived beyond 39, maybe today, if he were 77 and still talking, would he be the sainted Martin Luther King, or would he be been turned on by the United States?
I think to a large extent, I think this country would have turned on Dr. King. Not only the white and the power establishment, but I think some blacks, as they did when he came out against the Vietnam War, some of the national civil rights leaders was highly upset when he came out against the Vietnam War. One of them at that time was Roy Wilkerson.
Mm-hmm.
He was terribly upset by that.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. King felt morally he had to if he was going to be true to his calling.
Fred, let me put it to Taylor Branch. Mr. Branch, first, to Fred's question about Martin Luther King and LBJ, he says he doesn't recall an ill word toward the president from Martin Luther King in his lifetime. What does the record show?
The record shows that Fred is absolutely right, I can't find any reference where he criticized LBJ. He actually said, "I do not believe the president is a warmonger." He believed that I'm sure he would find our current political dialogue full of spitballs. He didn't throw spitballs at anyone. And one of the things that was striking to me was that the anti-war movement, the largely white campus-based anti-war movement that was inspired by the civil rights movement, I don't believe had that kind of discipline of nonviolence, not only in their approach to politics and demonstrations, but also in their public discourse, not to use violent language. And I'm embarrassed to say that people from my generation who vowed to be nonviolent often in practice were nonviolent for about 5 minutes and were quick to adopt kind of violent language. And in that sense, Dr. King and a lot of the other people, including Stokely Carmichael, mm-hmm. who had been nonviolent, going to jail for 6 years before mm-hmm. Black Power, showed a remarkable amount of discipline at the heart of what they saw as a democratic promise.
And what about Jack Beatty's point, seconded here by Fred in Florence, South Carolina, that if Dr. King had lived, he might well have outlived his popularity, maybe lost that sainted status that even in his life he said he didn't deserve. But what do you think would have happened?
Well, I don't know. I think these things are very hard. I mean, first of all, we have to remember that when he was killed, at the time he was killed, if he had turned on the TV to watch a Saturday afternoon college football game, it would have been all white players. That the world has changed in remarkable ways that we take for granted to end terror and change things that he could logically take credit for but is often not given credit for. But I think the other big reality is that a lot of the appreciation and the spirit for nonviolence and the positive potential of his movement has gone outside the United States since he died. In Europe, when the Soviet Union ended miraculously without violence, they were singing "We Shall Overcome" at the Berlin Wall and all along the streets of Prague. And in South Africa, people in my generation never expected apartheid South Africa to fall without some sort of Armageddon. And instead, Nelson Mandela comes out of jail and things change. So I think there's been a lot more appreciation for the potential of nonviolence outside and democracy outside the United States than in. But you just never know. He might have had a breakdown. He was certainly burning the candle at both ends. But it seems to me that a historical perspective over time shows that we take for granted enormous blessings from the forces set in motion by nonviolence.
In a speech delivered February 4th, 1968, just a couple of months before his death, at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Martin Luther King spoke directly to the issue of poverty in America. Here, King speaks about a time when he was in jail in Birmingham and started talking with the white wardens who said the civil rights demonstrations were wrong.
And when those brothers told me what they were earning, I said, "Now, you know what? You ought to be marching with us. You just as poor as Negro." And I said, "You are put in the position of supporting your oppressor, because through prejudice and blindness, you fail to see that the same forces that oppress Negroes in American society oppress poor white people. And all you are living on is the satisfaction of your skin being white and the drum major instinct of thinking that you are somebody big because you're white. And you're so poor you can't send your children to school. You ought to be out here marching with every one of us every time we have a march."
Dr. Martin Luther King, February 1968. Ray is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I want to congratulate Tim on completing the text. But I also wanted to ask how he saw Martin Luther King in the last period of his life playing a role to unite the two major organizing streams of the movement, the Black Power movement and the Black Civil Rights movement. The reason I'm asking is because I noticed that one of the major leaders that he met with very near to his assassination, the Nation of Islam, that was the most honorable right to Muhammad at that point. And also some of the rhetoric in his criticism against the war, you saw that that same rhetoric being echoed by Muhammad Ali. And I was wondering if there was a shared interest that was being built and whether or not he was capitalizing on this in a way that those two streams could begin to build a unity that may have provided an even bigger movement.
Taylor Branch?
How he saw that role. What part of his legacy mm-hmm. might that be?
Ray, let me put that to Taylor Branch. Mr. Branch.
Thank you. The caller is certainly correct. Dr. King met with Elijah Muhammad in February 1966, and he met with Muhammad Ali several times, but most publicly after Muhammad Ali announced that he would refuse induction, the draft for the Vietnam War, because he considered the war wrong. And he was willing to go to jail and give up his heavyweight crown for that. Dr. King met and actually prayed with him together in an ecumenical Muslim-Christian session. The one with Elijah Muhammad was before the Chicago campaign, and it was really more confined to that, and it was at the initiative of Elijah Muhammad more than Dr. King. But it was always Dr. King's purpose to try to find an ecumenical message to try to keep the Black Power movement and the nonviolent movement together. And it was very hard to do because there was just a media frenzy after Black Power came out for him to renounce it and essentially to try to create friction and a language of discourse, and he had a hard time doing that. He, at one point, begged Stokely Carmichael to come to hear him preach about nonviolence, militance, and radicalism, in which Dr. King said, just because you shake your fist and make noise doesn't mean that it's either militant or radical. It's just noise unless you're willing to put your body on the line. And what he was trying to say was that nonviolence was militant and radical, and in fact, Malcolm X himself moved toward that point of view when he went down to Selma just before he was killed to pay tribute to the nonviolent marchers in the Selma right to vote movement. So there are these tremendous tensions within the movement. Stokely told me that he and Dr. King became good friends when they met for the first time, just marching through Mississippi, even as Stokely is telling him, I'm going to use these reporters here who are following you to steal the movement from you on a new message that I think will resonate. And Dr. King said, I've been used before, and let's talk about this. Stokely and a lot of the people around him were, it was a paradox because they got to know Dr. King for the first time at the same time they were kind of splitting with him in public.
Ray, thank you very much for your call. Taylor Branch, we see that he drew a bigger picture here that went to poverty, went to justice and nonviolence, even globally in war, but on the central issue, the first issue of race, when you look out today, what do you think King would make of American progress or lack thereof on that front?
Well, I think that's a very excellent question from the caller, and it's certainly true that one of the things that Dr. King did in this era at great cost to the movement was to establish that race was not a sectional problem. When you look back on it, there are startling quotes of people just saying, well, some black people are fine, but others are still in the South. There was just an assumption that race was a Southern problem, and Dr. King in his campaign in Chicago destroyed that notion. At least he said we've got to grow up a little more and not, you know, baby ourselves into thinking that it's just a problem of ignorant backward Southerners, that this is a national problem of a lot of history. He also said, and to her point of what people could do, I think one of the strongest things about Dr. King was that he recognized the movement was built on ordinary citizens who became heroes when they took the promise of democracy and equal rights and equal souls and equal votes seriously, and they started asking questions and took responsibility for it. You know, to me, the inspiration here is not just his speeches, but the ordinary people, the Viola Liuzzo, the housewife in Detroit who drove all the way to Selma. The ordinary people who became heroes because they, as Diane Nash said, we own a piece of this country even if the country doesn't think so, and we have to act like it. And so she devised an answer to the Birmingham church bombing that became the Selma right to vote movement and brought the vote to 4 million new black voters in the South. And she couldn't even vote herself as a young black American in her early 20s. He's summoning people to a lot of citizenship, and he's essentially saying, you know, ask people, try to cross barriers, make new friends, take risks for freedom, keep the discipline of nonviolence, and struggle deeply with issues, because that's what, you know, the great American experiment requires of you.
At Canaan's Edge, the title of your book, A King Reference, explain it for us.
Well, as in the speech that you quoted there, I have looked over, I have seen the promised land, like Moses, who in the Bible, after 40 years in the wilderness, was allowed to go up on Mount Nebo and look over into Canaan, the land of milk and honey, but not go there. Dr. King's movement got up to the edge where he felt through the movement and the changes set in motion, he glimpsed the promised land without war, poverty, and racism. But he wasn't allowed to get there like Moses, and he was told, you can see it, but you're not going to get there. And he took solace saying, we as a people will get there because the goal of America is freedom, however much she strays from it, he said. And that means we as a people will get to the promised land. But he, like Moses, could only get to the edge and get a glimpse of it through the movement.
Taylor Branch, we've just got half a minute left here. You spent a lifetime working on this. I want to ask you, has it made it easier or harder for you to live in America today, to be so deeply steeped in the life and teaching of Martin Luther King?
It's been the greatest privilege of my life. It reminds me that there's room for hope if you do take the basis of your spiritual faith and your civic faith in democracy seriously, and as those people did in the movement, not just Dr. King, but the legions of people who joined the movement, that there's always room for hope, and that in some respects we don't appreciate how good we have it, because we all stand on the shoulders of that movement, and we should keep going again. I'm tremendously inspired and grateful that this movement occurred.
Jack Beatty, a final thought on those shoulders.
Oh, I can't say anything with that, except perhaps quote Theodore Parker, who King often quoted, the abolitionist. He said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. King was one of those who bent it.
We will take comfort in that and look ahead. Taylor Branch, for a life's work, really a staggering one, and your latest contribution here at Canaan's Edge, we thank you. We thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be with you and with Jack. Thanks.
Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Taylor Branch, author of the new book, At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965 to 1968. Jack Beatty, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.